Welcome to the Dingle Literary Festival. This is a pre-recorded interview, and as such, there will be no questions at the end, just to remind everyone. I'd like to begin by introducing Emma, who is the author of What White People Can Do Next. Emma is an Irish Nigerian academic and broadcaster, and the author of Don't Touch My Hair, which was published in 2019. Welcome, Emma.
Welcome, hello.
It's a pleasure to talk to you this afternoon. So I suppose my first question is, how did this book come about, and tell us like what started it and why you wrote the book in the first place?
So the book was inspired, not even inspired, it was like a response to, it was a response to the response of the murder of George Floyd. We were living in a period whereby sorry, one second. We were in a time where it was in the like the height of the pandemic, and there had been, this brutal killing of George Floyd that was recorded and widely disseminated online. I've never watched it, by the way. I've never seen that footage and don't intend to, but there was it created, it triggered like a global response. And the I guess across the world, people just responded to started talking about racism to a degree that I had never seen before or experienced in my life before. And it seemed like there was a long overdue kind of acknowledgement and desire to kind of finally do things differently, which, as I said, is long overdue. However, this was mostly happening on social media because we were in isolation, we were in lockdown, rather, and a lot of social media discourse is, while social media discourse just really skewers often towards the reductive and the, let me just say the reductive, and this was such an important conversation to be having. And beyond the conversation, these were really like important things, changes that needed to occur in our society. But the way a lot of it was being framed and approached, I was concerned that I was seeing what was essentially a historic opportunity for change being squandered. And one of the things that disturbed me actually was a lot of the discourse around allyship, and the kind of the main some of the mainstream discourse around anti-racism itself, and specifically allyship with this book. I could see that it seemed to be kind of, it felt very, certain questions and concerns were dominant, but they seemed very ahistoric, very kind of untethered from all of the work that, kind of grassroots activists and Black intellectuals of the past have kind of already done. And a lot of it just felt, like it was actually reproducing some of the problems it was purporting to want to overcome. So I wrote the book as an intervention to that. It was never my actual desire really to write about white allyship. I just felt like I saw this opportunity being squandered.
Yeah, and I suppose, yeah, I remember quite distinctly, like the Black Square, like there was a lot of harm being done on social media as well, like the Black Square being shared and stuff like that, that people had a problem with. And yeah, I suppose the book is called Allyship to Coalition. Could I ask you, could you describe the differences between those two states?
So allyship was Not appealing to me, because like in many ways I talk about this kind of trajectory from like white saviorism to allyship, and how allyship reveals itself or kind of can be situated within this same the same trajectory that we see this kind of figure of the white savior. And when I was so basically in the current kind of anti-racism, or in the anti-racism discourse that was, you know, mainstream and popular in the moment that I wrote this book, there were main tenets of it, and some of them were things like, do not expect to be taught or shown. So there was this idea that this was just like a phrase that you heard a lot: do not expect to be taught or shown. Okay. And then the other thing that you heard a lot was, Google is your friend. And I was like,
Google's not your friend.
Right. So I was just like, okay, so I'm a well-meaning, well-intentioned white person who wants to be a good ally, wants to contribute to anti-racist discourse. I don't really know where to start, but I can't ask to be taught or shown, can't expect to be taught or shown, but Google is my friend. Okay. So I took that advice and I like kind of Googled allyship, and the stuff that came up was just like really, really problematic. And I was like, I don't want people taking their cues from this. It's like, it goes back to what I was saying about having this like incredible opportunity, having this moment, but then not fully capitalizing on that and some of the potentiality of it, you know, being squandered. So some of the stuff
as well in that moment to someone to put something in Google as an ad and it takes them to something else. It's like, it's right? Not a reliable source of information. It's not a fixed entity. The cream doesn't rise to the top on Google.
Thank you. So you see the limitations. Yeah. And then also, like, there are certain things that you see being said as though they're like received wisdom. No, there are certain things that are received wisdom that you see being repeated all the time. And then you're like, no, there's not actually consensus on that. There are lots of other Black voices and Black thinkers that actually, you know, have argued the opposite of this thing that's become like the dominant thing in lots of the mainstream discourse. There's lots of stuff that's contested, but you don't necessarily see that. You just see this often in the mainstream anti-racism kind of discourse. You just see these very like these, what's the word? This kind of rhetoric, you know, that doesn't really help you think critically, but more tells you what to think and what to kind of regurgitate. And it's not necessarily, as I was saying, a lot of it seems, a lot of social media discourse is quite reductive and seems, you know, actually removed and untethered from the environments that it was generated in. So I go back to like people whose names we hear a lot in these spaces, you know, people like Audre Lorde, people like James Baldwin, like the Black Panthers, all of these, I mean, they're all quite different to each other, but all of these like radical voices who we've kind of taken like, you know, buzzwords and sometimes phrases from, but we're not really like engaging with their deeper insights. Mm-hmm. So I thought like a lot of the current mainstream online stuff was really ahistorical and was kind of taking stuff and almost like distorting it and removing it from its context. So I wanted to reconnect with some of that organizing of the past, some of that critical thinking of the past that is actually really inspiring and really like liberatory and far more robust than what a lot of the current, the kind of current online discourse seems to be. So when I was Googling allyship, you know, it was as one is kind of advised to, the stuff was coming up that was like, you know, really hand-wringing and really like self-flagellating. And it was like, I was seeing stuff like, oh, the allies' needs must be secondary to the needs of the marginalized person or of the victim. I was seeing lots of references to the ally and the victim. And I was like, the victim and the ally. Again, this was making me think of that like white savior dynamic. And I think that's something that I'm particularly alert to, having grown up in Ireland, like in the 80s and 90s, the huge kind of, most of the things that were known or ideas that people had about Africa or Africans, for instance, a lot of it came from the missionaries and kind of like the Catholic Church. And there was very much this idea of, you know, Africa as this place that was in need of kind of charity and help and assistance. And it was, like a place that required and people who required the kind of benevolent, charitable assistance of white people. That was such a dominant like theme when I was growing up. And in certain ways, in many ways, actually, allyship kind of, you know, fed into and reproduced that kind of narrative. And I was like, that when we have a discourse that says that allies' needs are always secondary, I'm like, how is that a stable place to build a movement from? Who tells you to kind of like diminish your own needs to kind of help others? And I'm like, who is that even appealing to? You know what I mean? That's not a very compelling, that's not like a world building practice. The type of personality that would be appealing to, oh my, I must diminish my own needs. My needs are secondary to the victim's needs. The type of personality that would be like arousing or appealing to is somebody that's probably inclined towards a type of, you know, saviorism tendency. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so for me, coalition is about identifying, coalition is about creating solidarity, whereas allyship is about, it's like kind of offering charity at the expense of solidarity. One of the other things that frustrates me a lot about social media generated kind of social justice discourse is the way it's really atomized and doesn't go far enough in, actually it's atomized and it doesn't go far enough often in joining the dots. We hear people kind of throw around, people are like, oh, capitalism, anti-capitalism, but actually a lot of the discourse, particularly around anti-racism, actually has no analysis of class, no analysis, no kind of analysis of capitalism. Again, if you look at those people that I referenced from the past, like the Black Panthers or Audre Lorde, the Combahee River Collective, most of the people who were very proactive in these in this kind of organizing, they were socialists or Marxists. So they have this kind of like critique of how the inequalities perpetuated by capitalism are actually really central to the racist structure and system that we live under. But that seems to kind of, again, be missing from a lot of the current stuff, as does a conversation around class. Race almost seems to, or race and class seem to be conflated. And so rather than really deal, so because there's this lack of a kind of underpinning theoretical framework, I feel like, you know, dots aren't always drawn to connect different things. But once you kind of have that framework in place, or more of a framework in place, you can see that so many forms of exploitation and so many forms of, yeah, let me say exploitation, be it the exploitation of the environment and the way that has created this extractive dominant way of viewing the natural world and the environment, and the way that has contributed to, you know, global warming and the current like ecological crisis, that's a direct result of, you know, the kind of system of capitalism that we live under. That same system is the one that created the architecture of race and subsequently racism that we live under. If we, and then also there are lots of people, you know, who are not racialized minorities, but they still have diminished life opportunities as a result of the inequalities that are perpetuated by capitalism. When you kind of join the dots between those different concerns and those different movements, you can see that the kind of source of the issue or the origin finds its it has the same source. So you can start to kind of build movements that, although the people might have kind of different concerns, there is a vested interest in working together to change the system, rather than, you know, something like allyship that just says, oh, I'm actually fine, I'm just this person that's incredibly privileged, my life is perfect, and I might help you because you're a victim and you're somebody that requires my help. First of all, that doesn't appeal to many people. Secondly, it's actually misleading and it fails to connect the dots between the ways in which, like, most people's life opportunities are, yeah, diminished because of the system of exploitation that we all live under.
Yeah, it fails to put the, it fails to identify the root. And
exactly.
People are kind of flailing around like, oh yeah, we're fighting sexism. And what does that mean? Oh yeah, we're trying to get into the top echelons of society. It's like, no, I have felt that since the Black Lives Matter movement last year. I felt myself have far better understanding of what we're actually doing. I was like, oh, right, it's capitalism. And then I really understood it, you know. And what you were saying earlier, I think, about when you were saying, like, not everyone agrees, you know, Black people are not a monolith, and being treated like a monolith the same way as Africa itself is not a monolith, like, it's made up of so many different cultures. So it's such an important conversation that we stop extracting the what people are saying from the root, and stop abstracting it, because I'm sure you've seen MLK has been used, his words have been used by conservatives the world over, and, you know, at the time he was a socialist, obviously,
right?
And yeah, it's like, oh no, he wasn't just saying let's have a dream, he was saying let's have a whole new system. So
yeah, MLK is such a good example. And I think his, like, radicalness is actually, you know, often or generally really obscured. And just before he was killed, he was actually working towards a poor people's movement. Mm-hmm. And he was advocating. So he was actually looking, again, you see this time and time again, he was actually advocating for a movement that was organized, I guess, more around class, because he saw that the kind of, you know, the gains from civil rights actually hadn't made enough of an impact on the material conditions of the Black poor. And he saw that, you know, so many people in the country were were suffering, diminished life opportunities, like impoverishment, and identified that if you could kind of tap into the fact that that was happening across the board and across racial divides, that would be, you know, this huge movement that's, like, so big that its demands can't really be ignored. And he was advocating for, like, I think it was like a form of kind of universal basic income type thing. So yeah, but you hear little about that kind of dimension of his legacy, and I guess he didn't get to come good on it because he was killed shortly after he'd kind of started moving in that direction. But you see that happen so often, like, again with the Black Panthers as well, more so than being based around kind of like a rigid identity politics. They were like revolutionary socialists. I mean, there was like a schism in the party because there were different, again, black people are not a monolith. There were different directions that the founding members believed they needed to go in. But certainly Huey Newton, who was one of the founding members, was kind of willing to work with, you know, radical white people and other kind of like radical groups. I think he distinguished quite strongly between kind of radical white people and liberal white people. And then you have somebody like a really powerful example is Fred Hampton, who was the head of the leader of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panthers. And yeah, he started this Rainbow Coalition that he saw that there were other groups of people who were not Black Americans who were also suffering as a result of the same system that was most oppressive to Black people. He wasn't saying that groups, so he basically started working with a group called the Young Patriots, who were these like disenfranchised white Southerners, and then another group called the Young Lords, who were like this Puerto Rican, who had this Puerto Rican former gang. So for the Young Patriots, he wasn't like, oh, they're experiencing racism. Like, as white people in America, they were not experiencing racism. White people don't experience racism, but they were experiencing, you know, like a lack of opportunity, really shit living conditions, and police brutality, you know, in the area that they lived in. So he identified, you know, enough common ground between these groups that would be imagined to be diametrically opposed. And in fact, if they were to fight each other, as everything has kind of been set up to create the conditions where that would be the case, they obviously wouldn't be working together. But were they to come together and work together in a coalition, again, it's bringing on so many different interest groups, because the root kind of concerns, you know, are the same. That again, yeah, he saw the potential to create again a mass movement that would be impossible to ignore. Obviously he didn't get to see that through to fruition, but that was the aim. And then it's like so much of the current discourse just seemed not even to be aware of this recent history. All of these demands for people to do the work, but I'm like, well, I don't really see who's doing the work, because if more of us were doing the work, we would see the links between this organizing of the past and what's happening now, and there's a great deal that we could learn from that. And I mean, if the Black Panthers had been demanding the kind of allyship that seems to be popular now, I don't think they would have really like, I mean, that, yeah, they wouldn't have the enduring legacy. They wouldn't have been perceived as a threat.
One of the most important elements of revolution or change is education. And like, that can't be underscored. So I suppose your work really is to try to really ground what is happening in the stratosphere, is that the word, back into like historical and historical reading and theory and movements. I was actually going to say about the Rainbow Coalition, but I couldn't remember his name or exactly who said it. to my shame, the only thing I know about Fred Hampton actually came from the movie that came out recently about him. So I have like little notes, but it's something that definitely needs to be told far more widely.
There's a good article about review of the new movie. Oh, it's not that new anymore, but of that movie, written by I can't remember the guy's name. He's like this Nigerian American writer, but he says that the film actually kind of obscures how radical Fred Hampton was, and kind of like presents kind of a Fred Hampton light kind of version that people still haven't really grappled with, like kind of what a radical figure he was, or it's not necessarily like conveyed in that film. But I guess if the film I don't think it's yeah exactly I don't you know people are like oh well the, this was different in real life. You know, there's this kind of onus on films to, I'm like, films aren't actually documentaries, but if they bring greater, if they introduce a historical period or a character to an audience that was otherwise unfamiliar with them, we know that there are lots of limitations to Google. However, there is still a lot, there is still a lot that we can, you know, explore and discover online about these people once we're aware of them.
So ideally what would happen with your book is that people go Googling or people go looking for the reading and they come across your work, which is far more is far more robust than, you know, 10 slides on Instagram that tells you like, this is why racism, point one, point two, point three, you know, which are, I think Instagram and that it has its space, right? It's a marketing platform, but there should be more stuff that people
Yeah, exactly. And I see things like kind of present, I see quite complex histories and phenomena presented on Instagram, and they're showing like a very, not just Instagram, just like online, you know, and they're showing, and it's not just social media. I'm starting to see like so many opinion pieces and think pieces that are written, and their sources seem to be primarily these online infographics. So they're also like super reductive and skewered. So yeah, it can be great for social media, can be great for introducing us to maybe ideas and concepts, but our learning cannot begin and end there. So yeah, I would really encourage people that are, you know, that do feel a commitment to, these changes need to happen, because basically, you know, the earth just actually can't sustain our current, our current way of being. Like, this change is just like, cannot happen quickly enough. So it's not even just like, oh yeah, I want to be a nice person and I kind of want to help. Like, it's kind of fucking urgent. So I would really like encourage people to read like the bibliography and what white people, or the notes section at the back of What White People Can Do Next has a list of, you know, books and thinkers that I've just found really transformative, that I would encourage more people to familiarize themselves with.
If I were to ask you, what can white people do next, you say they should read.
Yes, there's a section in the book, read, read, read and dance, because there are also other ways of knowing, understanding and disseminating knowledge. And also What White People Can Do Next, like very early on in the book, I talk about my own discomfort with the title of the book, and like the problems inherent in speaking to a generic global category of white people, you know. One of my major concerns with like the current anti-racist discourse is, while it doesn't, as I said, it doesn't engage with class, doesn't engage with capitalism, it has this like almost fetishization of privilege at the expense of really engaging with class or capitalism. But the other thing it does that is so pernicious is it actually like reinforces almost this truth status into these generic categories, black and white. And rather than it so much of it starts from a starting point, as though those categories are just natural, foundational categories that just exist in nature, rather than coming from the starting point that these are categories that are invented in the 17th century in order to enshrine a notion of white superiority and black inferiority, that they are intimately linked to the early phase of global capitalism, that we now live under, those racial categories were very useful in consolidating wealth, for in justifying and facilitating a system that consolidated, you know, wealth for certain groups under a form of global capitalism. And any discourse that doubles down on the truth status of those generic racialized categories, black and white, without, and actually does the work of race, does the work of race for it. If there is ever a moment, if there was ever a moment when we were really going to get to terms with and fully understand this mantra that you see kind of repeated, but often that deeper understanding of what it actually means is missing, that race is a social construct. If there was ever a time where we were going to mainstream an understanding of that, it would be now. And I don't really see that happening. I see people repeating the phrase, but I don't think there's necessarily the deeper understanding of what it means. And I certainly don't see enough reference to why, where, when, and how those racial categories were invented, and the work that they seek to do.
I just wanted to point to ask you about one thing that I've seen. I was listening to your Blind Boy podcast interview. I think it was in that one where you talked about the term, the new Irish word for a person of color, and that you said, like, oh, it's a pity that they gave up, or that we're not using the term gurum. And I actually saw on TikTok there are a group of Irish, Black Irish people who, I think it's GURUM is the name of the organization. I thought that was interesting that people might be actually adopting it. And I'd love to know what you think about that. Why do you like the term GURUM, or why do you think we should keep it, and why you dislike the new term that it has been invented for person of color?
So yeah, I know that I know that organization, GURUM, and I think again it just shows that there's not like consensus around these things. Mm-hmm. Like Black people think differently to each other in the same way that white people do, and a term that one person might find really like mixed race, you know, a term that one person might find really problematic, another person might use very comfortably. And we should be able to respectfully accommodate those differences. This is why I detest social media discourse, because it's not generally about respectfully accommodating those differences of opinion, but it's about kind of these polarizations, you know, and kind of not allowing debate and not allowing nuance, or kind of not allowing that diversity of opinion, which is the kind of basis of, I guess, like robust kind of debate and the development of these ideas. But I totally get why people wouldn't be comfortable, sorry, I'm just trying to think. So for me, why GURUM is interesting is because it's a term that predates this invention of race that I'm talking about in the 1700s. So anything that, so it's kind of inherently decolonial, okay? So it exists, it's something that exists from beyond and from before this taxonomy, this racialized hierarchy of people, and these invented categories of Black and white, which were invented to, you know, from the earliest inception, whiteness becomes associated with this idea of inherent superiority and virtue and kind of all that's good, and then Blackness by extension is like the opposite of that. So language or terminology that exists outside of that ordering of the world, it is exciting to me, because we should be trying to look at the world outside of that ordering of it as well, because that ordering of the world has really created like more devastation than I think we can.
That's so interesting. I think that, like, as a language, my degree is in languages, and the things don't translate directly as well. They mean different things, and it offers the new. I think that is one of the reasons I'm trying to going to learn Irish in 2022. I swear I am. And it's just like I want the eyes of Irish to see through it, and to maybe understand a little bit better what the Irish were thinking. And it's language offers us that in different ways.
Yeah, because like I think like so the kind of colonial view of the world that divides things into binaries, not just black and white, but also something I talk about in the book is like man and nature, or nature and culture, with nature, sorry, with culture and man, being dominant over nature, and that being the kind of framework through which we approach our relationship with the natural world, rather than seeing, understanding ourselves as more entangled with it and, a part of it, we actually see ourselves, we see man as dominant over it, which is the attitude and the way of perceiving that relationship that, has contributed to where we are now. So kind of racism, so many of the isms, so many of the burning kind of crises that we're grappling with at the moment come from this dominant, extractive, binary, colonized, kind of view of the world. Languages that offer us other, or cultures that offer us other perceptions, that offer us other relationships between the natural world and each other and with ourselves. They're really exciting. My desire isn't to try and remake them in the model that we're in now, I want to learn from them.
It's like going to Google for your information. It's going to mold it in a certain way because it's a certain framework.
Yeah, and I'm going to learn. I'm actually doing an immersive Irish course this summer as well. I'm really excited.
Oh, I'd love to. I need to. I think I'll have to find a really good. Might get a private tutor or something to come over and hound me. Okay, I think that is all. That was an absolutely wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Emma. That was so enlightening and an absolute privilege to talk to you today. So I just want to say thank you. And for anyone watching at the moment, our next online event is going to be Colm Tobin at 5 p.m. So I think that is everything. Thank you so much, Emma.
Thank you so much as well. And yeah, it was lovely talking to you.